I am especially thrilled to be able to present this session that runs until 4:45 called Building Beloved Communities. I've introduced you to Laverne Stokes and Alan Tibbles, Russell Zhang, and Mark Gornick. I'll simply introduce you again to Mark Gornick, the director of City Seminary in New York, in Harlem. Mark has been a fellow traveler with me and the Project on Lived Theology since its inception, and actually since an earlier run in Baltimore from 1998 to 2000. Mark is currently writing a doctoral dissertation at the University of Edinburgh. He's a graduate of Westminster Seminary, ordained Methodist Presbyterian minister. Wife Rita is in public health in the Bronx, parent of two children. And thank you for being here to moderate this, and I'll turn it over to you. Welcome, all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Well, it's really a privilege to be here, I think, for me personally, of course, and I think for all of us, just have heard what we've heard this afternoon. The topic is building beloved communities, and as Heidi mentioned, building the built environment is, from a community development standpoint, buildings are always related to relationships and community organizing, and in our context, reflection on scriptures and how it interprets our experiences and shapes our experiences as well. You may have heard the name Jane Jacobs, and you may know that she died yesterday. And Jane Jacobs had a huge impact, a big challenger to Robert Moses, and won some battles there. And Jane Jacobs was a person who really emphasized the dynamism of cities and the importance of small-scale approaches to urban living and to urban, the urban context and environment. We have three people who will be speaking: Russell Zhang, Alan Tibbles, and Laverne Stokes. They're going to be really in that spirit of talking about how they've been involved in building communities that is contributing to the strengthening of the urban fabric in their context. And rather than give other introduction to them, I'll just say that you will know them, the depths of their heart, of their vision, of their abilities to think sociologically and theologically, and all that they've brought to bear. You're going to know that by the stories they're going to tell. And so the format will be, Russell will begin, we'll speak for about 15 minutes or so each. Russell, then Laverne, then Alan. They're going to talk about the relationship between community building, the built environment, and God's justice for the city. And then after that, we'll have time for questions for all of them. So with that, Russell.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to thank Charles again for hosting us. My most vivid memory of one of these lived theology things was getting stuck in the snow out here in Charlottesville. I had to stay in a hotel near Dulles. But they didn't get any food, so I had to go to the gas station and eat peanuts for dinner. But Charles,
you were there for about 3 months.
But he graciously reimbursed me for those peanuts through the foundation. So it's good to be back here, and I appreciate the time and the talks that we've had so far. And if you have the PowerPoint, I'm going to talk a little bit about where we live in Oakland, California, and this community is called Oak Park Apartments. Does anybody need it? So the first slide you can see is a picture of our courtyard as it used to be. We're, it's a 56-unit apartment complex with mostly Cambodian and Latino families. It's probably the cheapest housing in the Bay Area in San Francisco. So in the first slide, you can see us playing with those, playing in the courtyard. And if you go to the next slide, what happened one summer is we moved in there about 15 years ago, my roommate and I, and through a series of events, the building deteriorated a lot because the landlord kept on collecting rent but didn't, you know, fix it up. And so my landlord, my roommate became the resident manager and said, okay, we're going to try to fix up this place and at least do some, you know, bring the building up to code. And so he told the kids, think about what would you like to do with Oak Park if you could make any changes. And so then he left to do some errands. And then when he came back, he found out that the kids got the wrong message. They thought he said, do whatever you know, what would you dream about for Oak Park? And they actually tore down all those fences, if you've seen the picture. And these are like 12-year-olds and under. They just like ripped down the fences because those fences blocked their play area, basically. And it was, so he came back and he started swearing and stuff, but I thought it was pretty cool that they actually took the initiative and sort of tore down. It was our little mini Berlin Wall. And for us living at Oak Park, that was sort of like a symbolic cue. You know how Rosa Parks was a symbolic cue for the Civil Rights Movement, or the Berlin Wall, was that it's one of those symbols that reflect that this is what change is about and what change needs to occur. And the tearing down of those fences before was for the kids, a symbolic cue that, oh yeah, change is afoot. Dan's going to become the manager. There's more hope now. There's something we can do. And so we eventually got rid of all the fences, and they were able to play in an open courtyard and, you know, play kickball and football and everything like that. So that's the first story. When I think about Oak Park, I just remember the kids wanting the fences gone and just needing an area to play and them creating that play area. Over the time we lived there, we formed what we called, Oak Park Ministries, OPM, but it was really informal. So our slogan was inspired by God, led by men, and funded by no one. Because it was really just an ad hoc thing. And actually, Kim That's Wells cool. was there in the very beginning stages of just hanging out when we just hung out. And so and we did that for a long time. Just hanging out with our neighbors, getting to know them, and having them welcome us into their homes. And that was sort of more of our grassroots organizing. We didn't have a strategy. We were just there to hang out. If you go to the next slide. Over time, though, we did get involved with a lot of the issues that they were facing. The bad environment. There were drug dealers living right in front of us, dealing right in front of, right next to my apartment, and hiding their drugs in our, we call them the fenders. I'm going to go too long telling stories. And so as we got more involved with the issues, we had to start developing a lot more ministries and programs as a result of the issues that people face and some of the needs that they express. And so we came up with sort of vision of what we would want for Oak Park. And a lot of it was rooted in my church experience where Craig Wong and Tina go to now, and the theology of that church. And so we took a lot of our understanding of what we've got community development from Genesis and what God intended in creation. And we had a sort of this four-point thing that actually Heidi also talked about. And the first point was that, you know, God originally had created a good integrated creation where man isn't the starting point. And that was really significant for us because our church taught us, how does the church meet your needs? And it was so sort of human-centric that we felt, no, we got to get our thinking off of ourselves and start thinking about, you know, God's glory and God's creation a little bit more. And so with the goodness of creation, the thinking of the goodness of creation, the implications for us was that the kids and our neighbors have to really learn to, and help us learn how to respect and cultivate our environment, because the kids would trash it, there'd be graffiti everywhere, there'd be a lot of vandalism. And so here you have a picture of a lot of us organizing the youth to do a neighborhood cleanup. And here we have like about 40 Latino and Cambodian youth getting done. And so just like Heidi had to repaint her building daily, we had to like paint out graffiti, and we did that with the kids a lot. And that starting point of it's not us being the starting point, but God and his creation as the starting point, well, you'll see has major significance. The other factors that we wanted to be about is that, well, God created us to have a relationship with him. That's the next slide. Thirdly, in the next slide, God gave us as humans a meaningful call to work and care for the garden, to name animals, to be fruitful, to be creative. And so we wanted to provide opportunities for our neighbors who are usually on welfare to have meaningful work opportunities, or for the youth who don't have very good educational experiences to have educational opportunities so they can reach their full potential, but not their full potential to become consumers in American capitalism, but to become fully realized so that they could be, you know, transforming society and caring for others. And then lastly, we were about developing committed relationships and building the church as the family. And so those were the points that we were about. And so that sort of guided us. So if you go to the next slide, organizing the lawsuit. What happened was that, if you remember during the El Nino years, it rained a lot. And so our building had deteriorated so much that everybody's roofs began to leak. And here you have a picture of one of the, this was a working bathroom with, you know, broken holes in the wall. There's mold on the ceiling and cracked windows. And so like Heidi talked about, we had a lot of asthma too because of the mold and the roach infestation. And so seven households had kids who were hospitalized that year because of the dampness and asthma attacks. One time it rained so much that our courtyard flooded, but the Cambodian neighbors go, oh, look at that. That's just like in Cambodia when it would flood. You know, sort of, in their vernacular, it was like, oh, it's cool, our, you know, our building flooded. And it was really fun that time because we were like, well, we were playing with the sandbags. But these were all grounds for a lawsuit. And here, the built environment was sort of unhealthy for our neighbors. And we tried to negotiate with our landlord to fix up the building. We had my roommate, Dan, try to manage the place so he could bring it up to code. But all those efforts failed. So eventually, we organized our fellow neighbors. And we had 44 out of the 56 households sue our landlord. And that was, in itself, like Heidi was talking about, standing up for their rights was as much of a miracle as the actual concrete changes that ensued. So, if you go to the next slide, or the next thing, it says Oakland tenants won a big settlement. You guys see that? So what happened was, after a three-year housing struggle, we won $1 million in settlement. And more significantly, we got the landlord to sell the building to nonprofits, housing developers. And so that ensured permanent affordable housing for our neighbors. And that was cool because the management was a major problem in terms of dealing with the drug dealers and things like that. Also what happened is not only did our little case affect our complex, but city council changed housing laws so that they created stiffer fines for blighted properties, and they also created Decent Housing Month and tried to do more public education, especially among immigrants, about slum wards. And so they would, you know, target the worst slums and say, you know, here they are, just to do this public shaming thing. And so Oak Park was named one of the top slums of Oakland for 2006. So that's when I got invited to the Live the Theology, because we had this great, successful housing store. We won. We changed the housing. We brought the building up to code. I got evicted because it became affordable housing, and I made too much, so they kicked me out. And if you look at the next slide, they opened up new Oak Park about 2 years ago. Yeah, hopefully you see the new improved Oak Park, right? And they tried to redesign it. Actually, the architect who designed it lived at Oak Park, and Kim knows him. And so she designed it to have more pitched roofs so that it wouldn't look like a concrete block, to have a more of a townhouse feel. They worked with the neighbors to design the courtyard to make sure that there were places where the elderly could sit, where there would be a community garden, where the kids wanted a basketball court, so they put in a basketball court. They knew that most people had bikes and not cars, so they put in a lot of bike stands. And so they did a lot of work trying to design the place with our neighbors' input. And they actually, usually they would just totally demolish the place, but we wanted to keep the community intact. So what we did is we moved all of the community into one half of the building, and then we built the other half. And then they shifted all of us, and then we built the other half. So that to ensure, you know, neighborhood continuity and community continuity. So that's all cool. And They built the building according to HUD guidelines. So when we had, we have Mexican and Cambodian families of like, you know, 8 to 12, all living in one bedroom apartments before, they all got 3 to 4 bedroom apartments, but at the same rent. And the building became a lot better maintained and regulated so that the management kept closer surveillance of people, put in security gates, and so, and institutionalized a lot of new rules. But the ironic thing now, and this is the thing that, where it's lived theology, is actually now, 3 or 4 years later, none of the tenants actually like New Oak Park. And so, ironically, we did all this effort to organize them and to win. And I think some of the changes were really good because they are living in healthier conditions. The kids and the families maintain it a lot better now because it is their own new property. And so there aren't any more roaches because people actually maintain their properties. But the place is just a lot more sterile now. And what happened is that as the kids got their own rooms, they retreated into their own private spaces and stayed there. And so there's a lot less social interaction. Whereas before, when they had one-room apartments, and the parents would be there gambling, it pushed all the kids in the courtyard. So that's what we liked, because you know there was so much life in the courtyard. But now everybody's back in their own room playing video games and watching TV, and they become like middle-class Americans in suburbs, right, where they're all sort of privatized spaces. It's a lot more sterile because of the HUD guidelines and the management. They don't allow the people to post things. And so a lot of the people's apartments, they can't nail things on their walls anymore. So, you know, a lot of their shrines are gone. A lot of their own vernacular artwork is gone, too. So if you ask any kid, do you like New Oak Park? These are like teenagers. I'm like, oh, no, we miss old Oak Park where we used to be able to play and run. And, you know, and you know, the ladies used to be able to sell candy or sofas out of their own apartments. They can't do that anymore because they're afraid of getting kicked out. So, it's, but it gets worse. Sorry. So we're a story of real successful community organizing, but really bad community development, and probably even worse church planning. But you know, sorry to be counter-modern. So there's a Chinese proverb that says everybody pushes a falling fence, and so. So we, all right, the Christians, we got the money out of the settlement, so we bought the abandoned crack house right in front of it, and we remodeled it and put in a preschool there and put in a tutoring center and an ESL program, so we have it used 24 hours. We have families living above for affordable housing, and we built it, we put these wooden fences up that are low to be warm and inviting instead of like the iron gates that everybody else puts up. And a lot of our neighbors, we put up iron fences. We went around once to educate people about health insurance opportunities, but people don't even have doorbells on their gates because they just don't want to deal with anybody in our neighborhood. But our church, we decided, okay, we wanted our church to be warm and inviting, so we put these low fences that are wooden. But what happens is that now the kids from Oak Park would hang out there and loiter in front of there and sit there and drink and hang out with their friends and deal drugs. So now the drug dealers weren't people outside the neighborhood. The drug dealers were the only kids that we helped work with originally. Mm-hmm. And they came from the families that whose homes we helped protect. And now the new management was threatening to evict the families now because their kids were the drug dealers, right? And so the church, we're sort of stuck in the middle where, because the kids are loitering on our property and sitting on our fence, people are getting on the church's cases for allowing them to hang out, right? And we're still trying to work with kids and provide them opportunities and meaningful call, senses of call and personal relationships with God, but they're still like last Sunday, no, Easter Sunday, the kids all came to our Easter service, and then like an hour later, they're all drinking in front of our church again, right? So everybody pushes a falling fence. So the kids are all hanging out there pushing a fence. So the neighbors started complaining about us as a church, and the management companies. And ironically, the same sort of policies that were instituted for us originally, that you could impose stiffer fines for blighted properties and actually force people to make changes, the city now is coming after the church because neighbors have complained about us letting the kids hang out there, and they're using those same policies that we helped, you know, design against us. And so they're making us build a bigger fence to keep out the kids, although the kids live in the complex. And so in Ezekiel it talks about how the ruling class, the rich, are oppressive, right, and unjust. But it trickles all the way down. And so even, you can't sort of romanticize before, so even our own kids are also now, you know, dealing drugs and also ripping off one of the neighbors. So it's not a totally, it's a complex story, basically, that now we're the church stuck in the middle, wanting to defend and help the families that we originally helped, but also facing pressure from government and our local neighbors who complain about us allowing this to happen. So what do we do? And we really don't know. So that's my last slide. And so Ezekiel talks about how there is oppression and injustice on all levels. And it says, I look for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land so I would not destroy it. So this is sort of our incipient understanding of our theology of built environment, is that, yeah, we have a falling fence, and yeah, we're caught in the middle, and yeah, we want to continue to provide meaningful opportunities. We want to develop the neighborhood. We continue to do youth organizing. But you never know what are the consequences of the changes that we make, right? And it's obvious. There's all these unintended consequences to our organizing efforts. I think in hindsight now, it was still the right thing to do to organize our neighbors. It was still the right thing to fight for better and healthier living conditions, right? And it is still better for them to have permanent affordable housing, even though you have all these other consequences. And it just shows that the struggle continues on, right? That it never really ends. So we're still like not there yet. And for us, and for me especially now, the lesson is that we got to continue to just stand in the gap and continue to pray, confess our sins, and understand that it is not a battle against just flesh and blood, not a battle about concrete and housing, but really a spiritual issue where even more now I think we're praying because we realize as much as we can organize, as much as we could change the physical structures, we still really need God's grace and God's help. So that's where we're at. Thanks.
Well, I guess I can start. I guess I'll start with the fact that I'm Laverne Stokes, but in Sandtown, the community in which New Song Urban Ministries has several different ministries, I am best known as Beanie. I grew up there. I've been there for 53 years, and I love it because it's home. In growing up there, Sandtown is about 72 square blocks, African American community. Used to have about 40,000 people, and I often say everybody in Baltimore just about flocked from south coming up, and that's predominantly where all your African Americans had no choice but to live there. And so I grew up there, and the funny thing about growing up there is I never knew it was considered a poor community. And I say that because, and I say it with very serious conviction, that the fact is that we were rich in spirit. And so that means so much more instead of all this materialistic things. And don't get me wrong, we want the best of things. But I'm just saying, when you grow up and you have an abundance of love and people in a community who really cares about one another, you don't realize that you were even considered poor. Growing up there, there was no such thing as a vacant home. You had an abundance of, if anything, you had an abundance of people and houses overflowing. And I sit to tell you today that's still one of the good things about Sandtown is that we are one of the poorest neighborhoods still in Baltimore City, However, the one thing that we don't have is homelessness in Sandtown. What you still have in Sandtown is you might have a two-story, two-bedroom house, and this is no exaggeration, with 20 people living in it. We've lost a lot of things, especially economics, but the one thing that we have never lost is a sense of community. And I find as we go around to different communities, and I find in different places, a lot of other communities lack what we have. And I really do thank God for that sense of community. Because I think the bottom line in all aspects is about relationships, really. So anyway, I grew up there in the 1500 block of Stricker Street. And I share with the children in our community at that time, I can go down the block and name mommy and daddy in homes. It was like Stricker Street is a block with about 40 houses on it, and I can tell you till this day there were two children who didn't have a daddy, and that was Regina Jones and Kathy. And but they did, because everybody's daddy was their daddy. And so you had extended families, you had people who really took care of one another. And saying all that, in the late 60s, well, early 60s, when housing legislation was passed, where African Americans could live wherever they deemed, a lot of people left Sandtown. The housing stock was never that good quality stock of houses, but at that time it wasn't vacant either. So you had just slum landlords who collected an abundance of rent even back then and did not want to fix up the houses. So a lot of folks left for better housing stock. And then after Martin Luther King was killed and after the city rioted, even in my community, you had a lot of businesses that did not come back to the inner city to rebuild. And so it was almost like a ghost town, actually. I often share with people that in my community, there used to be about 10 movie theaters. Today, there are still none. Everybody worked. I mean, I didn't know of anybody who didn't hold down a job, whether it was factory jobs or whatever, but we had jobs there for people who could work. We had what we called Bethlehem Steel. A lot of people worked there in different factories. And so when everything began to close down, you know, it was just a lot of hopelessness, really. And so back in, in 89, my oldest sister passed, and she left two little girls. At that time, they were 4 and 12. I was a single mom already of a child 7, and I believe Lisa was 15, can't quite remember. And so what happened was I instantly became a mom of 4. And what I would share with people, people would say, that, oh, that's so great, and I could never comprehend that. So great, what are you talking about? This is what's expected. I mean, at least in my family, this is what would happen had that happened to me or vice versa. And so saying all that, I really wanted to be the best mom that I could be, especially for my nieces losing their mom at such an early age and the passing of their daddies prior to my sister. So I wanted to leave Sandtown for better housing stock, but I love Sandtown, and for some reason, it was just home, the feel, everything about it. So I think it was back in, during that time is when my niece had became friends with Alan and his family. Alan and Mark moved in our community back in 1986, and I laugh about this all the time. If you can just imagine white people moving in, an African-American community with drugs, high rate of crime, poorest neighborhood in the city, vacant houses, I think you too would question why they're here. And so, and they have me on tape saying that. And I did question that. And my question was, what do these white people want? That's it. I mean, who could believe somebody would be moving in? And little did we know, we found out that they were coming in from their biblical calling to live among us, not just to get something started, but to stay there through the daily struggles and live out their Christian beliefs. And so I met these guys early on, throughout Children, actually. And it was my niece who, at that time, told me about a program called Habitat. And so she decided, she kept encouraging me, why don't you apply for a Habitat house? And so I did. And I think I was accepted about 3 or 4 years. I always tell the story to the homeowners that I now have been blessed to help direct the program, that their weight was no longer than mine. So be quiet, I don't want to hear it, and have a lot of patience. And so I was the recipient of a Habitat house. And I tell you, I was just so astonished to have something, a place so decent to lay my head at night, that I often share with people, be careful for what you pray for, because you just might get it. And so my prayer was that, my prayer literally was, oh God, if there was anything I could ever do for New Song or Habitat, then use me, because I was actually thrilled. And I think 3 months later, here I was interviewing with Alan for a position at Habitat. And so the story goes on that I became one of the directors now, and so running the Habitat ministry. But I just need to share with you that I really think, I am pretty biased about New Song, not just being on the team of the ministry, but having the effects of the ministry change my life. That's very, very critical. So I often say to people that I can certainly tell you the story with out holding back on anything, and say to you that what Alan and Mark did, what I thought was so very great about them, is that not that they only come into our community, but they did not come in with the idea of we're going to help these poor people and not involve us. And I think people have good hearts, very well, you know, their intentions are well. But if they fail to involve the people whose lives are going to be affected by it, your outcome is not going to be what you thought it should be or your expectations. I share with you that we have an abundance of ministries that Alan will talk about, but I think what's so great about it is that at least 75 of us on staff live right within the community. And so it is community owned. It is community involvement. It is community partnership. It's just not saying it, but you have to do it. I think, and I often share with people also, just because communities are poor, it doesn't mean we don't know what our needs are. It doesn't mean that there are no leaders there. Where do you get that from, you know? And I laugh a lot of times where I hear people come in and talk and speak, but we're your community people, you know? There are a lot of social ills in my community. What we need are the resources. What we need is justice. That's it. I mean, it's simple. You know, if it's fair and it's right, I find that people will take the opportunity if it's provided to them, if there is an equal ground for everybody to play. And so I think, though, that Christians, I think God's people need to step up to the plate. And a lot of times I do question people who say that they love the Lord, you know. How can you love the Lord and not do anything or not speak out about things that are not just or things that are not right? And so I'm not going to preach to y'all, but what I'm saying is I just think I fault churches. Churches have to step up to the plate, you know. If God's people don't do it, who will, you know? I think it's what we do at New Song is simple, and I was sharing this with Eddie a little while ago. It's simply loving people right where they are, just loving people right where they are. And I'll share with you what I shared with Eddie too. I said, you know, a lot of times for people who don't know God, it's very hard when you come to them, approaching them about God. And I used to be one of those people when I didn't know him. I would even say about my own sister, here she comes with that Jesus stuff again. I don't want to hear it. And so my prayer has always been, Lord, don't ever allow me to forget how far you've brought me. And to make certain that when I tell somebody about Christ, I am not telling it in a fashion where I am holier than thou. You holy people, just stay away from me, because you know what the Bible tells me, that all of us shall fall short. And so I think we need to be reminded of that too. And I think the best way, I think what's so great about New Song and what's so great about these guys is that they came in the right manner and simply loved people right where they were. And I think if you do that, as churches, as people, you will find that more people will flock to Christ simply because of your reflection of them and loving people. And I think New Song has loved people through all the different ministries that we've been able to provide, but we still have a very, very long way to go. But as I was also sharing with Eddie, I think for me personally and my community, the struggles just to survive, and I often share this with Alan, I think what we have in Sandtown, which a lot of communities I find don't have, is we still have a deep faith, a very deep faith in Sandtown, a belief in Christ that's so heavy when I look at folks there, because in order for people to survive, they've had to put their trust in much more than just man. And so, you know, we're continuing to work there day in and day out. We still have a lot of daily struggles. But I think what has happened is that the hope in our community has been lifted, you know, the hope in the community. And people are working diligently every day, I think, in partnership. We're certainly far from being perfect, but we're still there. And I often share with Alan, I believe that God has a calling on everybody's life, you know. And as I look back over my years, I think he was simply preparing me to come right to New Song and right to Habitat. Because I laugh so much about not having any knowledge whatsoever about housing. Nothing. Did you?
Still don't.
And still don't. We still don't know what we're doing. But I think with, you know, trusting in him, believing in him, will allow you to do anything. You know, as I listened to Heidi today speaking about the 8,000 people who gathered on that lot and who picked up that dirt, and even though they did not get that development, guess what? It wasn't in his plan. And that's how I look at things. He has covered every detail of our lives, and he knows. And so we don't know what his plan is, you know. But I think the thing is to, you know, hold your head up high and keep going, you know. It's not in his will, and that's how I personally have to look at things. But anyway, I'm going to pass it on to Alan so that he can really give you some detailed information about the ministry and what we've done and what we've been able to do only through prayer and persistence.
Well, that's real funny that I have to follow Laverne. Russell, of course, did a PowerPoint presentation, 21st century. We're still in the 20th century, so we gave you a couple handouts. And by and large, we won't really refer to them, but, you know, basically, we are in Baltimore and Sandtown, as Laverne talked about, and we can best be referred to as a church-based Christian community development model. And if you look at the sheets that you have, you'll just see a couple newsletters about that. But mostly the overview is called New Song Is, and that shows we began the church and then we began the different programs. But really based on the strategy, or the ministry strategy of Dr. John Perkins. And Dr. John Perkins had something called the three R's, and that was relocation, reconciliation, and redistribution. And so in that way, Mark and I, back in 1986, relocated into Sandtown. My wife Susan and our two daughters, they hate when I say that, because everything they've ever read now always says Alan and Susan and their two daughters. So they're the two daughters. But so they've grown up in Sandtown. It was very interesting for them to move into, you know, 100% African American community at age 6 and 9. And now they have loved the fact that, you know, that's where they grew up, and they've gotten to experience all the extremes in American society. But at any rate, you know, when we moved in, you know, we had looked at all the demographics of a lot of different neighborhoods. And, you know, places that are considered expendable communities, you know, like you heard about Robert Moses earlier, seeing the expendable communities, and so they can be torn down. The residents can be displaced. Sometimes they don't have another place to go to, and sometimes maybe they do. But nonetheless, those are seen even a lot of times when people come into Baltimore and they see row house communities, and our community had 1,000 vacant houses in 72 square blocks. So people are like, why would anyone want to live there? Or there's not a community there, obviously. Or, you know, the only people that are living there are those who could not possibly have an opportunity to live elsewhere. But, we, you know, you just heard, you know, firsthand a testimony. Those are places, which we actually really consider, those of us who are there, holy ground. They are places that people love, that families have been there intergenerationally, and they are places that are home and that are loved. There's a lot of problems there, and there's a lot of struggles there, but the residents of the communities like Sandtown love Sandtown and still want to be there. We just want to see the places revitalized and the things resolved. I mean, who wants 1,000 vacant houses? Laverne talked about how it was in Sandtown in the 60s, a thriving community, a thriving place. She did not consider it even poor, and so everyone loved being there, and then you had a lot of things happen. You know, as all of us in this room are familiar, over a 40 or 50 year period. Baltimore today, you know, New York, which you heard about earlier, New York had once reached 8 million, been down to 7 million, and now has gone back in even over 8 million. And so there's a housing shortage. Well, Baltimore is one of the few, major cities that are still considered an undercrowded city. So, you know, Baltimore reached about a 1 million population, and then has since, you know, white flight first and then black flight. And really, flight still continues even to this day, so we're down to about 650,000. So we're considered an undercrowded city, and we're also a very hyper-segregated city. So it's quite, it's quite sad that in 2006, and going back to even 1986 in America, a white family relocates into an African-American community, and it's seen as a huge, even in some cases, national for us story. And, you know, Laverne is like, a white family is moving into Sandtown, and that's how hyper-segregated Baltimore remains, which is very sad to this day. So anyway, one of the obvious facts is that a lot of housing is left vacant behind when a lot of folks move. And there's an ever-dwindling resource base, but an ever-increasing demand for services. So that's the problem with the undercrowded cities. I remember Mark and I in the early 90s initially reading Roberta Brenda's Gratz, and her first book, The Living City, and then more recently, Cities Back from the Edge. But, you know, she talked about, she presented this optimal urban environment, of which I love so much. And there are communities in Baltimore that are that. But, you know, if you look at a lot of parts of Manhattan, or if you look in Baltimore at like Federal Hill and Canton, and you see all of the houses are occupied, you know, things are opulent, you know, all the services are present, there's cafes, you know, there's businesses first floor, residents second floor. And, you know, then if you look at the undercrowded city like Baltimore, you're like, we will never reach that. We will never be there again. So on the one hand, it was very encouraging to know what optimal could be in the urban context. But then secondly, it was very discouraging. So anyway, in that context, one thing she talked about that caught our imagination was rebuilding your neighborhood house by house, block by block, street by street. And so in terms of taking the existing context, the existing environment, that a lot of people would look at and say that should be torn down. People should be, displaced, and then new residents brought in to new housing that are a moderate or higher income level. And so rather, according to Roberta Brenda's Gratz, you rebuild starting with one house. And that's exactly what we did. We started rebuilding with one vacant, and then we're 100% row house community. And then you do another house, and then more houses. And then eventually you complete blocks. And then eventually you complete entire streets. And so that is actually what has really happened in Sandtown. It's very exciting to see neighbors who have been there and sustained the community for all of their lives. Usually, as soon as things start to get revitalized, those folks are lost in the shuffle and have to move and do not get to share in the blessing of the rebuilding. So in our case, we followed the John Perkins model. We followed Gratz's advice, and Mark, who would never say this, but had so substantially networked, that really knew a lot of the principles to apply. And so the idea was those who are in the community and have sustained it for that long, that's who should own the community. That's who should, benefit from the rebuilding and benefit from the revitalization. So the first house ever was actually my former next door neighbor. She made $8,000 a year. She had children, and all of a sudden, she went to work every day and she made $8,000 a year. In 86, that's still not a lot of money. So the end result is she selected to be a Habitat homeowner. And so we worked with her, we worked with the neighborhood association, we did her house. It was beautiful. It was done almost entirely by volunteers, and everyone came to the dedication. The whole neighborhood turned out. The mayor, of course, was there. Senators were there. Congressmen were there. It was amazing. And why? Because it was a huge deal. Here's all of a sudden more people moving in, working with the existing neighborhood association, and a lady making, that's probably the first person in Baltimore making $8,000 a year to even ever receive a house for home ownership. So we've gone from there on, and then all of a sudden everybody came. They said, we know Roslyn. If Roslyn can get a house, then I can get a house. So then all of a sudden everybody wanted to come and get a house. And so a lot of people have since. So far 225 families now are in houses, and they're beautiful, and they have a lot of space, and they're really nice, and they're row houses. And so now there's that deep sense of community that Laverne talked about, and it was there, and then it was gone. Wasn't entirely gone, but now it's being rebuilt again. So it's actually amazing. And thousands of people come to work with us on that, but it is a very much neighborhood-owned and operated process. So there is a place that it was overlooked, but there is a place in which if you went in, you would say, okay, we're evangelicals, you know, coming in, and we're thinking, oh, we will go help. We will go make a difference. You know, the gospel will be brought to Sandtown. That's often how it's looked at. And yet there's a depth of faith there such as I had never seen in my entire life. And so who winds up being blessed because we move into that community? Me and my family wind up being blessed. The community gets some comic relief from our moving there. And Mark was probably laughed at even more than I was. But we really had a lot of fun, and we really have been blessed as a result. And all of the problems that we have been through, the community is all of a sudden, we grew up in individualistic America, and now all of a sudden we're in this sense of, you know, this place where there's a tremendous sense of community. So when we have problems, you know, probably in the early days we never even talked about those, but now that everyone knows everything. And so now you're lifted up by the whole community. And if you have problems, well, of course you have problems. Everyone has problems. And so it's actually quite a quite wonderful experience. Not to present it as all just anything that's easy or I don't think we're very successful in many ways. I think we really, have messed up a lot, and we really have a long way to go, as Laverne said. And, we're trying. I like your slogan, the no one funds it part. Because that's the key thing. If you're going to do community development in a specific context, especially the urban context, and even more so in the inner city context, you've got to have resources. They're not going to usually come from within the community. The physical and economic resources are not going to usually come from within the community. The other assets are. But so you've got to have the link to the resources. And so, that's been there for us. But that is a long, hard struggle. And the only way that that's going to resolve itself over time is if there is increasing justice, there is increasing shalom, there is increasing empowerment. And then eventually, Sandtown now is a place that is attracting people back to it, that is being rebuilt, and now we'll have some of the different issues to deal with. We won't have probably gentrification, quote unquote, but we will have developers wanting their pieces now all of a sudden. We will have prices rising. We will have property values going high, which is good, except for the accompanying tax increase, property tax increase. So, all of the issues of which I think everyone in the room is familiar, we're dealing with right there in Sandtown, but in a very unique situation because, we were able to move into a place that had so much pain and struggle, but therefore so much opportunity. And so, for us, it's a picture, a foreshadowing, of the kingdom. And it's a few of us, very weak human beings, just living out, our New Testament Christianity, sort of before the, thousands and thousands of people. You know, and I like what Charles, I mean, Charles has been very encouraging in many fronts, but one of the ways in which his book is encouraging to me is placing even more significance on the Christian community development efforts, because seeing them as a continuation of, you know, the incredible work that was laid in the civil rights movement. And so, you know, I mean, I think King, by 68, he had been very encouraged, and then great things happened, especially on the legal end. By 1968, of course, he was virtually totally depressed because of what had not happened on the practical carrying out of what had been won legally. Well, and that continues to this day, where we're still trying to, all of us together, trying to make that what was gained on the legal end, trying to make that the practical reality. And it's unbelievable that it's still, not to be discouraging, but it's not very far. It has a long way to go. Unfortunately, white America, you know, we think racism is over. It's a thing of the past. We're all race weary. We've been through that. And so, you know, no one wants to hear about what it means to pursue justice, to really have repentance, to really see empowerment, to really see shalom in communities. And so, you know, we just love being there. We really do invite you. Eddie and I were talking earlier, too, with about, you know, just come visit anytime, because we love just, you know, saying, here's what we're doing, here's our story. You'll be blown away by testimonies like Laverne's. There's just so many people that are so amazing, and, you know, we get the benefit from that. But then the specific place, it's just really cool, because everything we just talked about happens within 15 square blocks, within our 72 square block community. So anyway, thanks for inviting us, Charles, and thanks to Mark for, you know, doing so many things to bring so many people together, like now even. So thank you.
Well, we've heard three very powerful stories, and blending of theology, reflection on the built environment, and the continuing struggle for justice. I think it'd be great now to just questions to our three speakers, and maybe one way to do it, because we have three great speakers and maybe a number of questions, maybe we could get one or two questions together. Well, you can ask a question and someone else can ask a question, and then they can answer them together. How does that sound? Does that work?
I have a question for Alan. As you were moving there with small kids, I'm sure the question in the school districts came up, and your parents and friends probably said, well, the kids are going to suffer because of the education system. Can you speak to how their education was actually enriched,
sure,
or broadened, or if it's a tragic situation?
Well, it was a whole mixed thing. They were 6 and 9. We had been in Howard County, that was just outside of Baltimore City, and that's one of the top public school systems in the entire United States, and so they had the benefit of that. You know, it was the idyllic thing. They go to the end of the driveway, the bus pulls up, they get in, they go to a school, they get incredible education all day, they come home. You know, in Baltimore City, the first thing Susan did when we were going to relocate is go to meet with the principals of the three elementary schools in the neighborhood. And they quite honestly, all three left. I mean, that's not even embellished. They said, we can't educate your children here. That's ridiculous. And so, you know, and really the kids in the neighborhood over a period of time, as they shared, they saw the schools as warehouses, you know, as holding places. And I think the majority of kids thought they will get maybe through the end of middle school. And then middle school, all of a sudden, we never heard this in our lives. You know, Susan and I growing up, but all of a sudden, that was the big, that's when you celebrated. We're like, that is so weird. But almost no one graduated from high school. And that's how bad the public school system has been. It's not just a knock on the public school system. But again, I mean, it's just really a justice issue. So in terms of our kids, the principal said, there's no way you could possibly send your kids here. We still considered doing that, but, you know, they would have been 3 years behind, you know, like they would have had 3 years ago what they got each day in the class. So we actually wound up sending them first, for the first couple of years, to parochial schools, one in the neighborhood, one outside the neighborhood. And then eventually, you know, we sent our oldest daughter, because even in the parochial school, she had had the work 2 years earlier, and she was okay with that, but because I mean, academically, though, she really wanted to expand. But we decided not to have them as guinea pigs. And, you know, me coming in with my white guilt complex, I mean, it made it even harder to say my kids have opportunities. But, you know, so we made the logical decision, of course, and well-balanced decision to send Jennifer to, you know, the school where most of the millionaires' kids go. And so every day, either myself or Mark would drive 1,000 miles an hour to get her there on time, because it was 10 miles away. So she would be in a school where, you know, she's going to school during the day with the wealthy. And then being in Sandtown, as you heard Laverne say, one of the poorest demographic tracts in the United States, if not Baltimore City. The end result of all that, I struggled with that. Jennifer saw the good, bad, and indifferent of all the extremes in American society. So when I look back on it now, it's now been 20 years for us, but it's amazing. Like, I would love to have had growing up what she now has had. Now, I don't say that on her behalf. I don't say that easily. She would tell you that was very difficult, but she also loves the fact that she got to experience all of that. And now she has a love for the urban context. She has a love for diversity. She has a love, you know, the whole spectrum of American society, in a sense. But then on the other hand, she also has, she no longer fit into where she came from, she'll never entirely fit into, you know, an entirely different culture. Although she does say Laverne is her second mother, if not her first mother. So it's been an amazing experience, but our kids did parochial, and then private, and then went on to Eastern College, and then Columbia to do her grad work, and then my youngest daughter has just done some college courses, but that's been their educational experience. But very difficult. I mean, very difficult, and that's one of the main reasons that there's continuing population decline in a place like Baltimore, is the public school system. So we do have a school, and we became a public school.
I was going to say to him, it was very difficult on that part, but it was also a benefit for the community too, because not only that, I think it shed more light on Susan to try to do something more for the kids in the community. So it opened up a lot of doors for us, because then we all started little by little putting our kids in the private school. And then by middle school, one young lady, Ronnell, had just had it with the school and the teachers, and she actually went to Alan's wife and said, "Why can't you teach us? Why can't you homeschool us? Why can't you start a school?" And that was the wrong thing to say. Little did Susan know, God would see to it, that Ronnell came to Susan, I believe, in June. And in September, she had opened up a school. And so the kids have really benefited. We do have a school. It's a public school. It's from kindergarten to eighth grade. And so a lot of the kids have had an opportunity of a lifetime that they would have never, ever had. And prior to that, after the eighth grade, we had begun to, what I would say, farm them out, you know, to different schools. And then we also found, I mean, there's a learning curve in everything. Some things are just different for different cultures. My daughter was one of the first to ever go off to school. That was just horrendous for her. She went to Mississippi, you know, and that was horrendous. In my community, you just stay in it so close knit, and the children don't go away. And it was very, very hard on kids to deal with being away from family. But it was also an eye-opener, and I will never, ever forget when Gary came back to visit, and she kept saying to me, "Mommy, it looks different up here." And I said, "Okay." But the "Mommy, it looks different up here" kept going to, "Something's under that." And I said to her, I said, "Gary, what do you mean?" She says, "It looks dirty up here." Well, see, she had a chance to go to a private school down in Mississippi where the street, I mean, everything was clean, there were flowers, but it also allows them to come back and to know that they play an important part too in community and how things should be. But it's an eye-opener, but the education factor is so very, very critical, especially when you're talking about, we do no rentals, we do all home ownership. And so if you're going to buy a home in Sandtown, you want to make certain that your kids can be educated well and pop, you know. And so that's been working out pretty good, with the exception of the battle of the school system in Baltimore right now.
Yeah, let me just say one thing. I don't think Susan's here. I looked around. I don't see Susan.
She's working. Somebody has to.
Susan Tibbles is the director of Musson Community Learning Center. And the school is extraordinary. How many students are in the school now?
132
students.
And it's the preschool. I forgot. I'm sorry. 150 with the preschool.
150 with the preschool. And they're all neighborhood kids in this 12-block focus area. And it is equivalent of a charter school, though it is actually not a charter school. And it's in the midst of quite a, Laverne and Susan are, and all the parents and everyone in Sandtown are very involved in challenging the school system to fully fund these new schools. And if you're interested in that, I would encourage you to talk to Susan. She'll be, I think, around a bit. And also to look at BaltimoreSun.com. There's been a number of front page articles about Musson School, and it's really considered a model in the city and the state. So, and again, Laverne is a leader in that, as well as Alan, and Susan is the principal. So, and they built a brand new building. Talking about built environment, it's a new, how many square feet? 28,000 square foot building, first major new building like that in Sandtown. And it's extraordinary story that's part of the whole experience that Alan and Laverne were describing in the day of the birth.
Does Russell have any kids that he had to send to school or just through?
Yeah, that's sort of the beginning discussions are, sort of what to do with the kids. And interesting, one of the kids at Oak Park, not only did she get a brand new apartment, but she also got a brand new school that was built up the same year. So it's cool for her, but yeah, there's a lot of the same sort of organizing group that helped organize South Bronx. They're in our neighborhood too, and they started a lot of small schools, but they're just really hard to get into. And so one of our church members applied to 10 neighborhood small schools and didn't get into any of them. And so now she has to get, you know, send her to another crappy school outside the neighborhood or send it to a private school. And so it's a tough issue. I want to homeschool now because I like being with them, and then have day laborers teach them Spanish or something, I don't know.
Okay, question?
Just a quick question. Do you have an administrative credential to become a principal from June? Does she have credentials lined up, or are there ways to get her in? We've been groups of parents, and so frustrated with the school districts, we could do a better school than they could.
And that's a big issue. In the case of, Susan had her undergrad in early childhood. We started as a private school.
Private, right.
And she really had no intention of doing a school, as Laverne said, and unfortunately she had prayed, and so then she wound up being stuck doing it. But the interesting thing now, since we're sort of the equivalent of, we became a public school under something called the New Schools Initiative, and so Susan actually is not, so we have autonomy to make decisions on staffing, et cetera. So she's the principal of the school, but she is not actually an employee of Baltimore City Public School System. And one, she would probably need more certification if she is, although she's doing the schooling before that. But one thing that works to our advantage on that is the BCPS, Baltimore City Public Schools, gives us a certain amount of money for the principal position that we can then cash out however we want. So really that winds up funding three positions. Now I'm not very happy about that because, to say the least, because that means I have to keep raising money and getting paid too, but that works out to be good for us from that standpoint. But yeah, that's an issue. In the urban settings now, there's increasing requirement for certifications, and we've lost incredible teachers as a result of that, and we've also lost community-based staff because of that, and that we're very upset about that, but you have no choice, unless we go back to private. So it's an issue.
Why did you decide to go public?
Well, there was all of a sudden there was a call for either church-based groups or nonprofits to apply to run neighborhood-based schools. They would be called new schools. So a few foundations really encouraged us to apply. A lot of people encouraged us to apply, and so we thought, well, that's not bad, because we want to have impact on the public school system. We want to see the quality of education in our neighborhood increase, and so if we're part of that system and we have that academic excellence, then others will have to, you know, sort of step up. And then thirdly, we thought, you know, our budget, I think, was maybe $1.7 million, so we thought about $1 million of that would come from BCPS, so we thought it's easier to raise $700,000 than $1.7 million. So we applied and became a new school as a result of that, and, you know, we haven't really regretted the decision. I mean, but it's lately it's been very hard because of the struggle Mark was talking about to get, you know, adequate funding, which again is a justice issue for the entire Baltimore City public school system. But it has been good. We have had a major impact on the system, and you know, we have had the funding there that we would have had to raise otherwise. So that's why we decided.
I want to ask you guys a question about just you built things. You know, you built Habitat houses, you built you know, a school, and how has your community changed and responded to those buildings? I mean, the actual buildings themselves. Like, has design or like have they worked well? Because I mean, you know, I can't remember our first position.
Russell,
you know, like Russell's building didn't work in a way. You know, as you like, you know, what's the how has your building worked for your communities as you change the building?
It has worked for us because there are historical row homes, and we've kept them just as they are. The only difference is each house has its own character,
right.
And so it's really remained the same, and it has, you know, just works well for us.
Right.
Yeah, so the original footprint, it's much less dense than it used to be because so many houses have been torn down. But we have done all gut rehabs. We did one new block, and for that new block, we had the residents who would own the homes work with the architect to decide the design. And the funny thing is, it was almost exactly what had been there historically. So the original historic layouts for most, I think, inner city communities are outstanding.
Right.
And yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, not to bring up now, but I mean, we had Nehemiah housing go into our neighborhood too, and so we have different thoughts about that and how that fits in and works. And then the third part I was going to talk about is like the actual buildings we've done, because we built one new building, and then we've rehabbed some others, you know, for our space or commercial space. And again, that was with like the neighborhood considers that it's theirs. The kids consider that it's theirs because they really had the most to do with working with the architects to do the design, as opposed to us coming from outside and putting a building in and then hoping the neighborhood likes it. You know what I mean? So it really was a neighborhood-driven process, and the kids just really honestly think it's theirs, and the parents really honestly think it's theirs, and it really is. So that has worked well.
You know, the key thing, it seems like, is how much control and ownership do people have over the site, right? But I really struggle with the idea that you need to have a sense of ownership. You have to buy into the idea or to be, you know, help design it, to actually then respect the property or then care for it or then realize this is God's. And so I think it is, I don't know, I still sort of struggle over this whole idea of ownership and whether we need to have that ownership in order to really respect God's creation and to actually really have a sense of home, even if we don't own it. And so, I don't know what you theologians think about it, but for me, our neighbors are never going to be able to afford to own their own homes, right? And as much as we try to encourage participatory design in the project, they're not going to own it. and the price of land is just too prohibitive in the Bay Area to be able to own it. So the Habitat model, I think that really works because people do have ownership and they, you know, have a sense of community. But for my neighbors who are, you know, day laborers and immigrants on welfare, do you really need to have that sense of, to actually have ownership, to have a sense of home, to have a sense of empowerment, to have a sense of respect and a sense of dignity? And I think maybe it is just an American notion to own your own home, and maybe that's just the American dream that we think is sort of propagating this notion of, oh yeah, we take care of our property better because we own it. But I don't know if that's if it has to necessarily be true. So.
No, Eddie and I were talking, and I tell him, I think it boosts one's self-esteem. It does give you dignity.
Right.
I mean, you own something, it's yours. I find that the folks in my community tend to take care of it better, respect it better. It's a tool of empowerment. And we sit back and laugh all the time. Believe it or not, a lot of people in my neighborhood owned the house before they owned the car. I mean, a different twist. But let me share with you that after they got that house, on the 1500 block of Stricker Street, there were only literally three people who owned cars. And after was of owning the houses, the homeowners themselves had to go and get parallel parking because it wasn't enough space on the street for a car. Little simple things that we may take for granted on a daily basis, but it has done tremendously well in my community for people. They own a car. Okay, now somebody's child is going to college. You know, they're talking about college now, things that they never ever dreamed of. Not just the kids, but now the parents are going back to school. So I think it makes a world of difference when you feel a connection, when relationships are built and people feel as though they have been lifted up. And then you see them lifting somebody else up. It's like a domino effect. Or sharing with the people, I understand your struggles, I've been there, but let me, you know, you too can get through this. And then I often share with a lot of financial people and banking, and I have a financial background too, so I want you to know that we're not gonna put anybody in a house who's not gonna pay us. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, you'd be just messing them up, you would not be helping them. So we don't wanna create a welfare system. Eddie and I were talking, I tell them I can love you, but I'm extremely firm, I'm about lifting you up too. And we're not a welfare system or a dependable system. That does not work for people. If your heart's too kind for that, you need to get out because you're messing their lives up. But I share with a lot of financial people that they're missing out on low income people because what I look at is people need shelter, number one. They pay, in our community, they pay a bundle rent for a run down home. And they've bought it over and over again. And believe you me, they cannot skip that landlord. They'll be sitting out in the street. And so we find that a lot of people, when they come into the Habitat homes, our mortgages are actually lower than what they were paying in rent. It allows them some disposable income. And it is a way of empowering and uplifting. We don't have a perfect picture of note collections, so I don't want you to walk away with that. But what we do have, my God, people who I've known since a little girl, or most of the older people, who we hold a mortgage, so they run to the office to pay you. If somebody doesn't feel good, and I have older homeowners, and they call me and say, Laverne, I don't feel well. You know, payments due the first week of the month. Can you come pick the check up? And if I say yes and don't show, my goodness, they're ready to take my head off because they don't want to be late. So this is how well they appreciate and respect the fact that they have something decent. They're willing to pay for it. You know?
Well, I was going to responding to Russell's comment. You know, there's a lot of folks in our community that make less than $5,000 a year that live in, say, public housing, and I actually really do hurt there. And I think we're not, in a sense, benefiting the quote-unquote poorest of the poor in a sense in our community from that standpoint. I share that with Laverne a lot, and that's hard. So. I hear you on that, and I also think, you know, I think it's, you know, I think the whole idea of the American dream, I mean, you know, we don't value that, I mean, that's very ugly, but, I mean, I think in terms of the idea of quote-unquote wealth building, you know, which is, you know, the African-American community like Earl Graves and, you know, Black Enterprise Map, but I mean, they're, like, the biggest thing there now is, you know, wealth building through, the foundation for that being home ownership, so I mean, In our neighborhood, it's both things. It's great to see somebody now finally having equity, and they literally have something for their kids or something for their future and all that. But then secondly, there's a lot of people who still don't get to experience that, whether it's income level or whatever. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I hear you on that. I don't think ownership is vital, but I think it's a great thing for increasing justice and shalom over a period of time, you know, so.
But there's got to be a sense of connection that can be created to the land that's not based on ownership and power over it. right? It's a whole creation idea. It's a whole redemption thing. We're connected. We have a sense of home not because we own it and we have control over it or we could, you know, do what we want with it. It's because God made it and we're part of God's kingdom and we're part of God's family, right? And I think, right, so.
This is great, and I can't say anything either. But we have one more question. We have two more questions. Okay. And why don't you ask your questions one after each other, then we can answer them together from the front.
Well, I was talking about home ownership and whether or not you own it and going with it. Now, I forget what he connected it with, but he was talking about discernment. So, when, I think it's if you go forth with that discernment. But what came to mind was when children of Israel was at Jordan and for two tribes, he said, we're going to help you build, but before you can sell these to yours, you're going to go across and you're going to help these people build. So you got people that already own something, helping those that don't own anything. So I think if we use discernment on how to go forward with that, you know, we can take what we have, whether we own it or whether we not own it, but just being faithful and what we call to do and just trying to make it work together and instead of trying to create this or not create this divide that really keep us separated, whether we own it or we don't own it. Just say, okay, well, some own it and some don't. Let's just help each other move forward with this. And that's kind of the picture that came to mind as they were instructed to move forward and say, well, don't sell them yours yet until you can have the rest of the tribe, the other two tribes, get in the land and get settled in the land. So just kind of throw it out there.
And I just wanted to comment that there are lots of different ways of owning something. I'm involved with the housing cooperative here in town, and none of us could afford to buy a house by ourselves, but the model is that the people who live there own the house collectively together, and you buy in the member share, and when you have to leave, somebody else takes over your member share. And so just to put that out there, there are many different ways of thinking about ownership, even with people who can't afford to buy a house.
Yeah, I think
thank you very much. You know, I think one thing we've heard is that we have different urban contexts that we're discussing, and different urban contexts have different economic challenges and different communities and changing populations, which impact upon housing development, which has significant bearing on the future of community development. And yet, in these different contexts, I think what we've heard are some really extraordinary stories about seeking the peace of the city and contributing to the built environment, stories which are in process and by no means finished. I'm not sure your story's not a lot of great things are the way you...
Yeah, it's a side pitch.
Exactly. But in these new environments that, very complex urban environments bring changes and bring challenges that are unexpected, at which point then there's the challenge to rethink theologically and practically and to move forward. But in your efforts, we've heard witnesses to God's work in the city and to what can happen. And I think we're all encouraged to think more deeply about our callings and have learned so much from you. So thank you very much, Laverne and Alan and Russell, for really a very important time. Thank you.